Well, now to our final report this week, which really, depending on your financial circumstances, it seems to me weekends can be a time you feel utterly constrained or sufficiently in charge that you are relaxed and comfortable, because this is the time, after all, when the community goes out to play and money is generally required, even if it's just for the lovely few coffees I routinely consume after Saturday Extra with friends. If you're in bad debt, there's none of that nice, serene feeling. Debt's oppressive, and of course, it's what underlies all of the turmoil gripping much of the Northern Hemisphere right now, unresolved debt issues. Who owes what to whom? Can the debts be repaid? Who's going to accept they'll never be repaid? And it's been ever thus, if you seriously look at history, according to the man I'll introduce you to now. David Graeber has been involved with anti-globalisation protest movements in the 80s and 90s, and he realised then that much of his work centred on this question of who owed what to whom, but that there was little history about it, so he decided to do something about it. The result is debt. The first 5,000 years. David's a reader in social anthropology at Goldsmith University in London, before that at Yale. He's been described by the New York Times as a scholar and anarchist, whose books and articles are used in college classrooms around the world. He's also one of the organisers in the Occupy Wall Street protests. I think you're in Austin, Texas, aren't you, at the moment, David, taking part in the Occupy Austin?
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right. I'm going to be going over to the occupation right after this.
And how big is it in Austin, this protest?
Well, it's not bad. It's about 500 people, but for starting out, which has just started yesterday, that's pretty impressive.
So just before we move on to your bigger thesis about debt, what's your take on how this Occupy Wall Street protest got underway? Who's behind it?
Well, it was originally put out as an idea by a Canadian magazine called Adbusters, which is mainly made up of people who work in the advertising or marketing business or used to and became sick of it and essentially tried to join the other side. But they just threw it out as an idea, and they threw out a date, but they didn't actually do the hands-on organizing. So I heard about the General Assembly they called, that was on August 2nd, showed up with some friends, and we rapidly discovered there was a very traditional left group, had a platform and megaphones, and they were making speeches, and we said, we want to do this. So we kind of broke off and formed a real democratic assembly, and things just took off very rapidly from there.
So has it surprised you what's happened?
It's startling. I mean, we were afraid, mainly, we only had 6 weeks to organize this, that, you know, these kids were very enthusiastic, but they're all new to it, and we were just afraid they were just going to get brutalized and traumatized and jailed, and that would be it. Instead, not only did they get away with it, and they proved incredibly dogged about sticking to it, but it just blossomed. I hear there's now 407 different similar cities across America that are doing this.
Yeah. No, it's certainly an amazing thing to watch, and whether it morphs into something more, it remains to be seen. I want you now, if we could, to talk about this question of debt, because you say debt has come to pervade every aspect of our lives, but a lot of us don't understand it at all. In your mind, as an anthropologist, what is debt?
Well, what you have to do is you have to distinguish debt from obligation, because we tend to think of everything we owe to each other, knows that word, in terms of debt, as if debt is the model for our moral relationships. But really what debt is, it's a kind of a promise, but it's a promise of a very peculiar kind. It's impersonal, and it's mathematical. And because it's mathematical, it can be impersonal, and because it's impersonal, it can be transferable. So normally, if I made a promise to you, you couldn't give that to someone else. It's that which has its gives it its strange power.
So that, in fact, you're distinguishing between debt, like a personal debt from me to my son is something personal that can't be transferred. Well, I suppose, yes, it could still be, because he could borrow the money to pay me back. That's your point. The minute it goes beyond a one-to-one relationship, it develops this less personal character.
And the moment it becomes circulating, it can become money. And according to many theories, money actually is a debt. Economists, of course, argue constantly about the essence of money, as there's many schools, but that is one of them.
And you, and then you say, because I'm sort of cutting to the chase, because yours is a big argument of yours, okay, that you are a great believer in debt cancellation, which is what's so pertinent at the moment in the world, and that countries like big countries and big lenders can choose to cancel debt. Why would they do it? And what does it reframe then if they do?
Well, it's a matter of, first of all, recognizing what money really is. Because we have a tendency to talk about debt as if it's sacred. Which, now, of course, debts between equals are almost never treated as sacred. If very rich people owe each other money, or debts, you know, between the financial elite are constantly renegotiated, there's this completely normal. And debt between poor people, you know, if my brother is in trouble and I want to give them some money off and I'll say it's a loan. You know, everything can be renegotiated. It's when you have debts between people who are not equals, between poor countries and rich countries, between poor people and rich people, suddenly people act as if the very idea of abrogating a debt is a violation of some sacred bond. What we have is a situation where money is more and more a political instrument. It's not tied to concrete commodities. It's a political arrangement, a set of credits or IOUs. And well, if they can be renegotiated at the top, as we all learned they could in 2008, they can be renegotiated at any level. And I think what people are saying is, you know, if democracy is to mean anything, it means that everybody should be in on this process of deciding what kind of promises we can keep and what kind of promises we have to renegotiate.
But ultimately, I see what you're getting at, but debts, if someone routinely or an entity goes into a debt without even an intention of honouring that debt, doesn't it fundamentally undermine the basis of proceedings all round?
Well, exactly. If you have absolutely no kind of social trust whatsoever, then all you can have is coercive enforcement, and you have to be absolute about these things. But you have to remember that social trust isn't going to happen if you don't allow for a certain amount of renegotiation. So in a way, it's a vicious cycle. In a similar way, for simple economic theory says that you have to have a possibility of default, because if you don't, there's no reason for creditors to guide their resources toward productive investments. You know, if anybody they lent it to, no matter how absurd their project was, had to pay back, it would just force the money out of them somehow, well, the entire system would fall apart.
So
it works the other way around.
Have you come to the conclusion, because you feel so constrained by what you see as the indebtedness of poor countries, which is your whole work in the anti-globalization movement, have you come to the view that it has to be able to be renegotiated, which may not be the view of people who did the loaning in the first place, which gets back to the business of the sort of the honour involved in honouring a debt?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have to remember that if you're talking about the global south, you're not talking about default in the sense of they borrowed the money, they're not going to give it back. We're talking about the terms of interest, because all of them have given back much, much more than they've ever borrowed. So it's a question. That's why I say renegotiation rather than cancellation. There's a million ways to do it. And as I say, if AIG, American Insurance Group, or these too big to fail people get into trouble, they always renegotiate. They finagle things. Trillions of dollars have been made to disappear. Why do we suddenly apply a different standard? Why are countries not too big to fail?
And why? What is your answer to that?
Well, my answer is I think a debt moratorium of some kind would be appropriate. It would be a way of signaling, okay, we're in a different world. And one of my arguments of the book is if you look at human history, we've sort of alternated between periods dominated by virtual credit money, where money is essentially a set of promises or social relations, and periods where people are actually using cash in everyday transactions rather than credit, and where money is seen as a thing. The original form of credit money. Now, we've been moving into a period of credit money, but we're still thinking about money in old-fashioned terms. But in a way, the virtual credit money isn't new either. It's really reverting to an old pattern. Every time in human history there has been a period dominated by virtual credit money, there's always been some institution to make sure things don't get out of hand. Either you have periodic debt cancellations, as they did in ancient Mesopotamia or ancient Israel, or they get rid of interest-bearing loans entirely, as they did in the Middle Ages.
So I wonder what that means now. Does that mean that Greece should default on its debt and that the French and German banks should wear it, as Argentina did?
No. Well, I mean, Greece will default on their debts. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the question is how they're going to dress it up. Some loans simply can't be repaid.
And that once you come to terms with that, if I hear you, you get back to, you're saying, so sort of join the rest of human history, and this is the way society moves on. Is that it really?
Exactly. I mean, I think of it this way, if you want to think of the morality of it. If a debt is just a promise, why are certain types of promises considered more important than others? For example, in the UK, where I work, politicians came to power promising to eliminate student fees and swore a mighty oath to the public not to raise them. As soon as they got in, they said, oh, that's not realistic, we're in debt, we're going to triple student fees. Now, why is it a promise to the electorate is considered made to be broken, but a promise to a bank that is, some of these banks are even owned by the government, is not considered made to be broken? You could equally say, well, you know, if people don't keep their promise to the electorate, no one will ever vote, and democracy will be imperiled.
We call it core and non-core promises, we call it here. David, we've got our time is running out. Look, thank you very much indeed for joining us. I do appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
David Graeber, whose book is actually just come out now, called Debt, The First 5,000 Years. You might like to seek it out.